Good evening, everyone. Hello and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talks, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on making good food choices in an urban environment. This is our 86th episode. Nutrition and diet are a popular topic on Cure Talks, and today we are going to explore and understand how our immediate food environment affects our food choices and attempt to tackle the question of whether consuming organic foods can help us stay healthy. To do so, we have with us two very distinguished panelists. Dr. Sean Lucan, he completed his MD and MPH degrees at Yale before earning an MS in health policy research as a fellow in the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program. He is currently on the research faculty in the Department of Family and Social Medicine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and is a practicing family physician through Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx. Our next panelist is Samantha Heller, registered dietitian, exercise physiologist, senior clinical nutritionist at NYU Langone Medical Center, Center for Musculoskeletal Care and Sports Performance Center, a SiriusXM radio host. Samantha's new book, The Only Cleanse, a 14-day natural detox plan to jumpstart a lifetime of health, will be available starting May 26, 2015. My co-host of the evening is Matt Goldman. Matt is a multiple myeloma survivor who is discovering nutrition and its advantages in keeping healthy. Towards the end of the discussion, we will be answering questions sent in via email by our listeners. If you have a question for our panelists, please press 1 on your keypad to let us know, and we will bring you on air to ask them. The modern day city is designed for unhealthy eating. The very systems put in place to protect us are skewed towards profitability, not nutrition. And the results are skyrocketing levels of obesity and chronic disease. This toxic food environment is a complex problem that requires reforming at all levels, from government and industry to local institutions and families. Until that happens, it's up to us to find solutions in the small choices and changes we can make in our own lives. In this discussion, Dr. Sean Lucan and Samantha Heller will talk about the modern food environment and deliver some practical advice to help us make healthier food choices. With that, it's over to Matt to begin with the discussion. Matt, you're on air.
Thank you, Priya, and welcome Dr. Lucan and Ms. Heller.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. Brian Lansink, director of the Cornell University Food and Brand Lab and an authority on eating behavior, mentioned in his book about food rating. Quoting him, he says, "Most food choices happen within 5 miles of where we live, our home, two or three most frequented restaurants, our main grocery store, our work, our kids' school. If we tackle that, we'll not only eat better, but have a positive effect on our families, our neighbors, as well as 80% of people who don't care what or how they eat. So our immediate food environment is important for us to make healthy food choices." So given that, today's show is about how we make decisions about food and how our decisions are shaped by our food environment. But I would imagine for many listeners and even myself, the idea of a food environment is new information, is something we don't know about. So Dr. Lucan, can you explain a little bit what a food environment is and how it influences the choices that we make?
Sure. So broadly, I think a food environment is just the context within which individuals make dietary decisions. And there are many aspects to a food environment, social, cultural, economic policy. Recently, there's been a lot of interest in looking at built environment or, you know, actual food sources. So where people get their food, the sources of those food, and what types of food are available at those sources. So a lot of interest is looked at, you know, restaurants and food stores, other aspects of the food environment, like farmers market, street vendors, non-intuitive storefront retail, and that all kind of collectively is what we refer to as a food environment.
Okay, thanks. Ms. Heller, do we even stand a chance at making good choices in present-day society? We all like to think that we have free will and that we choose what we eat, but how much of a choice do we really have nowadays?
You know, that's such a great question. I certainly have people who listen to me on my radio show on SiriusXM who call in and say, I don't want my food choices to be regulated. Don't tell me what to eat. And what they don't realize is how incredibly manipulated they are by the big food companies. Food ads are everywhere. They're on television. They're on billboards. They're on your smartphone. They're on your computer. When you walk into a grocery store and you smell coffee at the Starbucks right there, there's a Target near where I live, and I was there today, and the first thing you smell when you walk in is pizza and popcorn. That's not a mistake. The way a food court in a mall is lit, the music, the color, all affects our food choices. The number of ads on television, if you watch TV when you're hungry, forget it. You're just going to want to eat every ad that comes up because their job is to make you want to eat their food. So we are living in a food environment that doesn't support healthy eating in general. And so what we want to do is create a food environment, at least in our own homes, that can help us eat more healthfully. And we can do that, for example, just by stocking our pantries, our refrigerators with healthier foods, because Brian Wansink, who you referred to before, in his research, he has found that we will eat what is in front of us. So we will eat the first thing we see in the refrigerator, the first thing we see in the cupboard. So instead of having the cookies be at the front of the cupboard, either don't have them in the house, or if that's impossible, put them in a different cupboard or in the back of the cupboard. Have some whole grain crackers there instead. He did a study where they put the fruits and vegetables, they took them out of the crisper bins and brought them up on the shelf where you could see them, and people ate significantly more fruits and vegetables when they were right in front of them. So if we can change our own personal environment and understand that the environment that we live in when we get out on the street, when we leave our homes, is not necessarily conducive to healthy eating, then we can be more aware of the influences it has upon us as we go through our day.
Wow. So we do have free will, but we need to be a little bit focused and thoughtful about that free will, it sounds like.
Absolutely. I think we're affected in ways that we are, of which we are completely unaware. And I think when we're really thoughtful about what we have in our homes and we become more mindful eaters, when we're consciously aware of what we're choosing to put in our food cart, what we're choosing to bring into our houses, what we're choosing to put into our mouths, then we can start taking a little more control.
Right. Dr. Lucan, what is an ideal food environment? Does it even exist in Western society, or is it just a matter of bad, worse, and terrible? Or are there any communities or neighborhoods or areas that we can look at as models for having the ideal environment?
So I think, as Ms. Heller suggested, an ideal food environment is one that puts real food in front of people, real whole food, and makes it available, accessible, affordable, and makes it so that it becomes the default choice and something that people choose to eat over, you know, food that's not conducive to good health. And unfortunately, in most of the places where people live, there's a lot of unhealthy food. There's a lot of exposure to unhealthy food. There's a lot of exposure to unhealthy food marketing. And, you know, those can be overwhelming forces for many people. But, you know, the context of the food environment has to be considered in the context of the individual and the individual resources. So one environment might not be the same for two different people. Access to healthy food depends a lot on people's financial means, people's access to transportation, people's educational level and understanding and where to get healthy food, people's understanding about cooking and food traditions and if they know what to do with whole food. So It's a complicated matter. I don't know that, you know, are there communities that do it better? I would say, you know, rural communities, more agrarian communities, communities that are, you know, more based on farming and cooking and kind of, you know, old traditional food ways, kind of have it more right than sort of these modern food environments that are, you know, largely, as noted, you know, kind of very much prepackaged, processed, less healthy food items.
Mm. And Doctor, how would you say, sort of building on what you said, how would you say that the modern day food environment differs from previous decades or even centuries? How has it changed over time?
Well, I think increasingly it's become more artificial, more refined, more processed, more prepackaged, more convenience items, more fast food. You know, we used to be an agrarian society and grow our food, and there was a lot more knowledge about, you know, how to grow food and how to prepare food and cook food and share food that we made ourselves. And, you know, eating food that came from whole plants as opposed to industrial processing plants. And I think that's really shifted a lot, you know, not even over the course of centuries, but even over the course of decades. You know, it's a profoundly different food environment today than it was, you know, even just years ago.
Mm-hmm. And Ms. Heller, you touched on this already, but could you go into it with a little more detail in terms of what are some of the things that you recommend people do so they set themselves up for success?
You know, as Dr. Lucan pointed out, it's very individual. Some people live in cities. Some people live in areas where they don't even have a grocery store nearby. Some people have a lot of money and can have food delivered to their house or hop in their car and go to the grocery store. So what we need to do is we need to find out what works best for our individual environment, what works best for you in the healthiest way possible. If you live in a city and you don't have a grocery store nearby, you can still possibly, you know, maybe plan ahead. Planning is key. It's key in being able to schedule out, carve out the time to get to the store, to lay aside the money you need to buy the foods you want, to be able to review what the coupons you have, what's on sale, what's available, what you can afford, you know, cans of beans, frozen foods, pasta, rice. These are things that are pretty affordable and pretty healthy, even if you're in an urban, you know, environment where things are not as available as one might like. But to stop and think about what you want to do with your life. I think people feel so overwhelmed with the amount of information that's being thrown at them from every angle, the internet and television and newspapers and magazines, that they don't really know who to listen to and what's true and what's not. And I know I experience this, Dr. Lucan, and I'm sure you do, patients coming to us with all kinds of crazy information and ideas that they're hearing that are expensive that they think they have to do to be healthy. And really, if we can just get people back to basics, back to really almost simple eating to start, maybe cooking at home a little more often, because as our environment has changed, even in recent decades, as Dr. Lucan mentioned, I have patients, whether they're in the country or certainly New York City, who just, they don't even want to boil water. They don't want to even have to cook at all. So how can we accommodate those needs? If they really don't want to cook, how do we instruct them, educate them on what you can do to get healthy food if you're not going to be cooking or not going to want to cook a lot? On the other hand, I'd love to encourage people to cook more at home, and maybe if we tried that a little bit more often, occasionally we'd realize it's not quite as difficult as or time-consuming as we think it is.
Right. It's not as daunting as people think.
You know, honestly, I lived in New York City for a lot of years, and when I moved out of the city a few years ago, I basically had to learn how to cook. I didn't cook in New York City. People use their stoves to store their sweaters. I mean, most of the kitchens aren't even usable for cooking. So when I moved and to the country and I had to start cooking, there's certainly a learning curve, but I actually almost never go out to eat now. I really like cooking, and I can get home from a long day of work and whip together a pretty decent meal in about 45 minutes. And I think if you can kind of stock your pantry with those healthy, non-perishable things that you can throw together relatively quickly, it's great for you and the family, and in the long run, you save money.
Right. Yeah, and I think your statement about planning ahead makes good sense. It just seems like we're all sort of programmed to go, 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 and everything needs to be instantaneous. And so it seems like even with eating, you know, we just want to be able to eat right away. And so planning ahead and have your pantry stocked and refrigerator stocked is probably a good idea. Dr. Lucan, what correlations have you found in your research between our food environment and chronic disease, or just disease in general? Are there populations that are most affected by a toxic food environment?
Well, certainly my research is based out of the Bronx. So, you know, I'm a family doctor at a federally qualified healthcare center right in the city. And so I take care of a population that's predominantly low income and underserved. And, you know, it's that population, kind of urban low income minorities, that I think are disproportionately disadvantaged by the negative aspects of food environment. So it's generally in those types of communities that you see, you know, the greatest preponderance of sources of unhealthy food, so fast food and convenience stores and, you know, outlets selling predominantly, you know, pre-processed and packaged industrial items, and less in the way of whole fresh foods and sources of whole fresh foods. And, you know, as Ms. Heller said, you know, there's a lot to be said about planning ahead and stocking your pantry and, you know, having healthy foods available. But, you know, a lot of my patients, as well-meaning, as well-intended as they are, you know, just are not in an environment where that is very conducive or very feasible or even possible in some cases, or it takes an inordinate amount of planning and resources and, you know, just kind of more effort than a reasonable person is able to put in to access a lot of healthy items. Now, I mean, certainly there are ways around it, but when you're up against an environmental context working against your best efforts to keep you and your family healthy, it can be very challenging. And so we know that, you know, communities like the ones in which I practice kind of have a disproportionate amount of unhealthy food availability, a disproportionate amount of unhealthy food marketing. You know, even within the community, I've done some studies, you know, just looking at food advertising in subway stations, and it's, you know, the stations that are located in the, you know, kind of the low income, low education, high immigrant populations that, you know, have the most amount of unhealthy food advertising. And these are the communities where there's the, you know, the most unhealthy food available too. So those are the populations that I think feel it the most, and are also the populations with kind of the worst health outcomes, with the worst diet-related disease rates, the worst rates of obesity, the worst rates of you know, issues directly related to food that would benefit most from a change in that kind of environment.
And Ms. Heller, just continuing on that topic, what are your thoughts about income influences on our decisions to eat or not eat well? And do you feel like that it's largely a low income issue in terms of having access to good food?
Well, having access, I think, has a lot to do with income and socioeconomic status, and studies are indicating that. There was a recent study in the British Medical Journal finding that, you know, increasing age, being male, living below the poverty threshold were, you know, big factors in eating a high-calorie, less healthy diet. And, you know, people who had more economic resources ate a greater variety of food and, you know, had those options available to them. So certainly it makes a really big difference in terms of what you have available and what you know and what you understand and how you're targeted by the food companies, which Dr. Lucan alluded to as well. There are resources out there for people. It's hard to navigate the system when you're in a city, so that's difficult as well. And we're really trying to encourage people to make healthier choices and have those foods available at all income levels. I think, you know, I think it's a bit of a myth that healthier foods are more expensive. As I mentioned before, you can buy dried beans, you can buy, you know, big bags of brown or even white rice, you can buy, you know, large cans of soup, and you can go to the box stores and get, you know, a lot of food for a decent price. But one of the drawbacks to that is what I see when people go to some place like BJ's or Costco's or Sam's Club, is they'll look and say, wow, look, there's three cases of soda for $1.99. So then in some ways they're more apt to buy less healthy foods because they think they're getting a better deal. You want to be able to afford it, but sometimes you're tempted by things that are conceivably a better deal but really aren't a better deal for your health.
Right. And doctor, do you think that the government should step in and regulate the food environment any more than it already is? And are there even places that we could look at that are taking some initiatives to put regulations in place?
Well, certainly New York City has been very progressive in terms of regulation and policy. And, you know, policy solutions are certainly one tool in the toolbox. But, you know, as with, you know, any well-intentioned intervention, there's almost inevitably unintended consequences. So, you know, we have to be really careful and thoughtful in thinking about how to regulate or how to legislate to make things healthier. There have been, you know, attempts to, you know, address issues as diverse as zoning for fast food. There was a study recently that I believe was from LA that showed that a fast food zoning ordinance to try to limit the amount of fast food in neighborhoods didn't really result much in the way of having a beneficial effect on dietary outcomes or downstream health. And that wasn't very surprising. There are other targets of legislation, things like you know, trans fat bans and sodium bans, and I think some of the political attention to single nutrients can be misguided, and I think single nutrient focus in general can kind of steer us in the wrong direction. I think, you know, really we want to be focused more on whole foods and broader dietary patterns, and I think, you know, a place where probably we could see good change is, you know, driving demand. So rather than, you know, relying on the government to regulate or relying on policymakers to legislate, trying to increase demand for healthy food and using some market dynamics to try to improve the situation. So, you know, there's some advocates out there who would suggest to people that they should vote with their forks or vote with their wallets and, you know, choose to push industry to provide what people want, and if people want healthy food, the industry will provide it. And so, you know, there's probably a combination of approaches that could be beneficial, but I think in terms of government regulation, one has to be really thoughtful about policies that are put into place so that we don't do more harm than good in trying to implement those measures.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Once found only in health food stores, organic food is now a regular feature at most supermarkets. And I think that's created a bit of a dilemma in the produce aisle. I know even my household, it's a real dilemma. You know, on one hand, you have conventionally grown fruit and vegetables. On the other hand, you have fruits and vegetables that are organic. Apples, for example, you know, both are firm, shiny, red, both provide vitamins and fiber, and both are free of fat, sodium, cholesterol, you know, the so-called unhealthy stuff. So I guess the question becomes, well, which one do we choose? I have here the definition of organic food is mentioned in the USDA website. Says that organic is generally free of synthetic substances, contains no antibiotics and hormones, has not been irradiated or fertilized with sewage sludge, was raised without the use of most conventional pesticides, and contains no genetically modified ingredients. So, building on that, doctor, what exactly constitutes organic food? And what is there a difference between natural food and organic food?
So regarding organic food, I mean, I think you just gave the USDA definition, and organic is a regulated term that now has meaning through that definition. So that you know, those criteria basically describe what organic food means, or at least what it means today. I mean, it used to just be that organic food is what your, you know, grandmother would have just referred to as food. And what we call conventional today is, you know, would have been unheard of. So, you know, it's kind of a bit counterintuitive, actually, that the, you know, the food that's considered conventional, the thing that's considered kind of the predominant model, is the one that's the least like what had been done historically, the one that least resembles how our ancestors would have farmed and would have produced food. Regarding the term natural, that's a meaningless term. That is something that industry uses and advertisers and marketers use basically just to confuse consumers or make them think that food is healthy or desirable or has certain benefits for them or the environment, but it's a completely meaningless term. So organic is a regulated term that has the definition that you said, or natural is a term that just basically has no meaning.
Basically,
yeah, when my patients ask me about natural, I say, you know, dog poop and arsenic are natural, but it doesn't mean you want to eat them.
Agreed.
Very good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Ms. Heller, do you, in that definition and what we just talked about, you know, we're talking about organic, and the doctor touched on it a little bit a couple questions ago. You have organic, but how does nutrition fall into that? Should nutrition be part of the discussion sort of separately or specifically?
Well, you know, there are studies that have looked at the nutritional content of organically grown fruits and vegetables or grains compared with conventionally grown. And some studies found that there was a difference. Some studies found that there weren't. Overall, I think both are healthy in terms of their nutrient content. But organic it's really all about production methods and no antibiotics and hormones, pesticides, herbicides, fertilizers. It's about the environment. It's about animal welfare. It's about the whole picture. It's not just about whether your orange that's organically grown has 5 more milligrams of vitamin C than the orange that was conventionally grown. So I think we need to look at the big picture. While there may be some better value in terms of organically grown fruits and vegetables, maybe a little bit of a nutrient here or there. And again, the studies are conflicting, and sometimes it depends on who's funding the study, what your results are. It's the whole picture, and what we're finding in the broad spectrum is when we're using pesticides and insecticides, we're having bee colonies collapse. That's going to affect the entire world, and we're so self-involved that we don't pick up and lift up our eyes to look at the world and say, my gosh, what I'm doing in my little backyard can actually affect something thousands and thousands of miles away. The songbirds in the state where I live in Connecticut, the population is declining because they're eating insects that have been, you know, contaminated with pesticides and insecticides. So organic farming in the long run is better for the environment. It's better for the planet. It's better for animals that are raised for consumption or for the products that they produce. So we want to look at the whole picture. So it's better for everybody. And it's certainly better not to, you know, I don't want to have those pesticides and insecticides in my body and in the bodies of children or even my animals. So we want to do the best we can. And if we can support organic agriculture or our local organic farmers, that's great. We can't always do that. We can't always afford to do that. So I don't want people to think that just because they can't afford an organic apple or an organic bunch of broccoli that they shouldn't eat it. They absolutely should eat it because they're still really healthy for us. But when you can afford to go organic in certain things, I think that that's a great thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And Ms. Heller, how is certified organic food different than organic food, you know, if we're out shopping and we see that something's certified versus something that just says organic? What's the difference there?
I don't think they can say organic unless they're certified organic. The USDA has a certification process that distributors or farmers have to go through. They have to be inspected. They have to meet a whole number of criteria. They have to pay to get that certification. So when you see that something is organic, or Dr. Lucan, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it has to be certified organic if it says organic in the grocery store. Is that true?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Yeah, so, but what that doesn't mean is if you have farmers who live nearby and they're growing foods organically and they say it's organic, but they can't afford to or haven't gone through the process of being certified by the USDA, it doesn't mean their food is not organic, you know, when you're going to the farm stand or the farmer's market. So one of the reasons we like to support our local farmers and go to farmers markets or the farms themselves, if you happen to have those available in your community, is you can actually talk to the farmers and find out what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would just add, I agree completely with that point. I mean, knowing your farmer can mean a lot, because as Ms. Heller suggested, I mean, a lot of these farmers might not have the means to certify as organic when they might be using, methods in agriculture and food production that actually exceed or that are actually superior to the criteria needed to establish that bare minimum. And just because of food, I should mention, just because of food is organic, you know, does not necessarily mean that it's
healthy.
doesn't necessarily mean it's healthy, certainly. But even, you know, to the point earlier about, kind of sustainability issues in the environment and, our impact on the planet and environmental concerns, which are all, you know, vitally important and critical. If you take like organic eggs, for instance, you can have chickens that are raised organically. You know, they're given nothing but vegetarian feed and raised in organic settings by organic means. But, you know, they would be raised in conditions that many people and many, animal rights groups and many who are concerned about the environment and animal welfare would just be horrified by. Even designations such as cage-free, so that just means the chickens are without a cage, but, it doesn't mean that they're not, you know, housed in these, giant sheds with overcrowding and little access to the outdoors or the sun. And they can be raised in really kind of unhealthy conditions that are unhealthy for both the planet and the environment and you, the consumer, but still meet the strict definition of organic and try get a health halo placed over that product. So, you know, organic is a start. I mean, it's a good sort of simple, one-word dichotomy that consumers can look for in a store, but it's not an absolute guarantee of, you know, the highest standard in, sustainability or farm integrity or food production. So there's more that goes into it. The more you can know about your food, the more you can know your farmer, the more you can buy locally, the more you can know the source, the better for everybody.
Right. And I guess the follow-up for both of you, given that, where can the consumer find out information about how chickens are raised or about how animals are raised? Are there websites? Are there private organizations? You know, it seems like you'd have to do a lot of research to figure some of these things out.
So there's a very strong interest by the food industry to keep you in the dark. If people knew how most of their conventional industrial food was produced, I think they'd be horrified and disgusted, actually. So there's a very strong incentive to keep consumers from knowing the processes that bring food to the table. So it's hard, especially when your food is produced by these, you know, giant multinational, conglomerates. So I think, you know, getting back to Ms. Heller's point about, you know your farm, know your farmer, buy locally. I mean, if you can shake the hand of the person that, you know, produced your food and talk to them, I mean, you can, you can learn everything there is to know about how the food is produced, and you may even be able to see the farm. In most industrial agricultural practices, you know, there's this great secrecy, and I think, resistance to the consumers knowing anything or seeing anything. And I think, you know, if you tried to walk onto a farm, you might be escorted off by armed guards, whereas, a local farmer, you know, might invite you onto the farm and want you to see how their product is produced and want you to see the kind of, you know, high integrity methods that they use to produce your food, which is, you know, again, just hearkening back to, you know, yesteryear and comments I made before. I mean, that's what food was. I mean, now we have to think more about our food and the food production because it's been so adulterated and so, you know, for lack of a better word, contaminated by these powerful influences. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the past, healthy food used to just be food, and now it's, you know, there's a lot of really unseemly practices that go into what brings your food to the table.
Mm-hmm. So again, consumers really need to make their voice be heard by where and how they spend their money, that's the way to start making some bigger changes, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, Marion Nestle, and I think Dr. Lucan, you were kind of referred to her. She has a book out called, it's Eat With Your Vote With Your Fork and Vote With Your Vote.
Yeah.
And she talks a lot about, you know, companies take notice when they make money. That's their bottom line, is they want to make money and they don't really care how they're necessarily treating the animals and the, you know, how the food is produced, and they don't want you to know about it. Michael Moss wrote a book called Sugar, Salt, Fat, or Fat, Salt, Sugar, where he talks a lot about the secrecy of the industry. I'm supporting basically what Dr. Lucan had just said. So, you know, if it's a big company, you can always call the company. There's smaller companies coming out where you can't necessarily go to their headquarters and walk, you know, walk into their facility and see what they're doing. But the smaller companies tend to call you back. You'd actually get a human on the phone who seems to be able to answer your questions. Mm-hmm. So that may be a good thing that consumers can do, is pick up the phone and call. Say, I actually did this with a vegan margarine, and you were using palm oil. And I emailed, and they emailed me back. So I said, I'm concerned about Malaysia. They're using child labor. They're destroying the forest. They're destroying habitats for the orangutans. And they emailed me back and said, we're using sustainable practices. We're trying to use more organic, and kind of laid out what they were doing to not work in a way that I was concerned about. So I was pleased that they actually responded. I would like to assume they were telling me the truth. I can't say for sure that they were, but sometimes reaching out and the consumer voice, you know, sometimes these companies listen, and we feel like we're screaming into the wind. Certainly politically I do. But if you can call the smaller companies, I do think they listen to the consumers. So it's good to be active and be proactive in what's happening in your grocery stores, and talk to your grocery store manager. If you don't have farms nearby, if you don't have local farmers, if you live in the middle of a big city and you can't get out of the city, talk to your local store managers and ask them, where are you getting your food, and do you think you could get more local, and see what they can tell you about what they are bringing into their stores for their neighborhoods.
Yeah, I think that's true. And just to piggyback on that point, I think, you know, some stores now even have rating systems or these scales that you know, talk about certain foods in terms of their, you know, sustainability or the production methods or what went into raising them. And so, you know, that can be a tool for consumers. Another thing is there are independent groups like the Environmental Working Group that have food score systems that look at not only at nutrients but also at the number of processed ingredients and the types of ingredients and production methods and rate different products on that scale. But I would say, as a general rule, the more health claims a product is making, the more it's trying to advertise, the more yellow and big font type on the front of the package trying to get you to buy it, probably the more you should try to stay away.
and it's also again, I think Dr. Lucan and I are really on the same page here. It also supports us just trying to buy more whole foods and less packaged foods. It's not that you're not going to buy packaged foods. I bought a bag of organic corn tortilla chips today for a party I'm going to be having, and that's a processed food. But buy less processed foods. Make more foods at home. You know, instead of buying a box of rice that has a flavor packet in it, buy some brown rice and add your own spices and herbs to it. Instead, you know, make your own bread. You can buy a bread maker and make bread at home that costs you a lot less than it would than the loaves of bread in the stores over time, and it doesn't have all of the fillers and all of the chemicals in it. So there's ways you can actually do that and save money, but it does take a little bit of thought, and there's a little bit of a learning curve. And if you're willing to do that, it's certainly worth it.
I agree.
Does it seem like consumers that we're having a little bit of a shift, and consumers are getting smarter and making better decisions and starting to vote with their wallet?
Dr. Lucan, I would ask you, because you're up in the Bronx and you're working with a very specific population, do you feel like your patients, when they come in, are making better decisions or understanding a little more about what's happening?
I think it varies. I think it varies very much by community. So I work in the Bronx, but I live in, you know, an affluent neighborhood of New Jersey. So I would say, you know, the parents at my son's school, absolutely. I mean, they're voting with their forks, voting with their wallets. My patients in the Bronx, not really high on their agenda.
Yeah.
You know, they've got bigger issues to worry about and more pressing things on, you know, kind of the hierarchy of needs. So. You know, I'm happy if I can get them, you know, to eat a few more fruits and vegetables, kind of regardless of what form they came in or where they came from or, you know, how they were raised. So, you know, it's baby steps and, you know, knowing the resources and limitations of the people that you're working with.
Yeah. It's the thing is, and Dr. Lucan and I would say, I'm not speaking for you, but you have to meet the patient where they are, or the person, or the student. I have people call into my radio show and say, why can't you just tell everybody they have to eat more plant-based diets and this and that? And I said, because if I have a patient who comes to me and all they eat is processed food and they eat at the diner, they breakfast at the diner every morning and they go to McDonald's or Burger King or Popeyes for lunch every day and then at night they have a frozen meal, I'll be lucky if I can get them maybe to have oatmeal in the morning instead of the, you know, bacon, egg, cheese, sausage thing. You need to meet people where they are and you know, baby steps is a good word. A step-by-step, just maybe not buying soda, maybe trying some seltzer or some water instead. Some, you know, the making these behavior changes is very complicated, and people's relationships with foods is based in a lot of emotional and psychological relationships as well as financial and environmental. And as research is suggesting and some books are suggesting, you know, the foods are actually formulated by food scientists and psychologists to make people crave those foods even more, those processed and less healthy foods. So it's even harder to get people to make that sort of shift in their taste and their preferences.
Mm-hmm. And what about schools? Schools in terms of both the toxic food environment that students are experienced, but also as a way to educate kids as well. How are we doing there?
It's an interesting question. I actually just had a piece come out in the Huffington Post last week regarding school and school education. So Jamie Oliver is kind of a celebrity chef who had this whole Food Revolution Day campaign to try to, you know, bring food education back into the curriculum and, you know, bring some of those lessons that we talked about earlier about, you know, food growing and food procurement and food cooking and food sharing. And I think most of the focus on food in schools has been around the lunchroom. But the point of the piece that I put in the Huffington Post was that, you know, the food exposures at school extend far beyond the lunchroom and include, you know, class parties for, you know, birthdays and holidays and other celebrations. They include, you know, bake sales and fundraisers. They include vending machines. They include, you know, treats that teachers bring in to reward students. They include, you know, after-school programs and sporting events. And in all of these venues, it seems like the predominant food source are, again, these highly processed, prepackaged industrial items with less focus on, you know, whole, fresh, you know, sustainably produced real food, like actual sustenance. And I think that works very much to the disadvantage of our kids, you know, not just in terms of reinforcing, you know, unhealthy habits and behaviors and tastes and preferences, which can last, you know, with them throughout their years and you know, into adulthood, But also just in terms of immediate consequences, in terms of, you know, physical and mental performance and, you know, risk for chronic disease. So I think it's a big issue, and I think it's something that needs to be addressed, and I think it's something that, you know, parents have to play a bigger role in, that physicians and, you know, nutritionists and dietitians should be a part of that conversation. And it's something that we should really focus on as something that's not separate from the rest of the curriculum, but integral to the other curriculum, so that kids can be successful. I think schools should be in the business of building healthy kids, and I think we haven't done a great job with that.
I love that it's part of the conversation now, though. I love that, you know, Jamie Oliver at least got on television to talk about it. I love that they showed the pushback he got from the lunch ladies. I love that we're having the conversation now because it's a big deal. But last fall, I was asked to review a local after-school program, snacks for kids. I think they were 5 and 6-year-olds, and they sent me the menu and what they give these kids after school, and it was grape soda, Rice Krispie treats, Skittles, brownies, chips, and I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was surprised and so hugely disappointed. And I wrote back and I emailed them back and I said, can't you have yogurt for them? Can't you have some fresh fruit? Can't you just have some sunflower seeds if you can't have nuts in the room? I mean, do you have to have Rice Krispie treats? And again, as Dr. Lucan had suggested, it affects their performance, it affects their weight, it affects their mood, it affects their energy. So I was not, you know, disappointed. It's a lower income area, very blue collar, where they don't have a lot of access to financial support. But I said, still, you could the money you're spending on the grape soda and the Rice Krispie treats, you could certainly buy some yogurt. And I'm hoping they made some of those changes.
Well, when you do ask that question, Ms. Heller, what answers do you get, or how much pushback do you get?
Well, I didn't get much of an answer. They just needed a dietitian's signature on a piece of paper for some state to meet some state requirement. But I did write back, and they said, well, you know, we'll talk to the people we're getting the food from and see if we can't make some of these changes. But I don't know if they made them or not. I hope they did.
Yeah, I mean, I can say as a parent, you know, my son attends a private school, and I know, you know, parents at other private schools have had similar conversations, and I'm, you know, been in discussion with teachers and administrators at my son's school, and it's an issue that's important to me, and I think, you know, important for the school in general. And I think there's been a lot of receptiveness, but it's not a public school, and so I think the conversation is different when you're talking about an entire school system rather than a single mm-hmm. institution. And so, I also was glad that this issue got some press and that it's on the table and that people are thinking about it, and hopefully, you know, we bring more attention to it, because I think it's vitally important. I don't think that the healthy lessons that we try to teach at home should be undermined when, you know, kids leave school, leave home and go to school, where a lot of these unhealthy foods are not only endorsed but often celebrated. You know, they're often given in the context of these, you know, parties or special events or other things, where it's not just that the healthy food is made available, but it's something that's special and, you know, kind of sets kids up for unhealthy habits, behaviors, and tastes and preferences for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you this, doctor. Do you see kids getting diseases that in the past maybe kids didn't get, that they're starting to get things that they didn't used to get, if you will?
Well, I mean, I've only been a physician for, you know, just over 10 years. In my practice, I don't know that I've seen a change, but I certainly see diseases today that physicians years ago did not. Diabetes is the classic example. We see, you know, what used to be called adult onset diabetes now in children, and that's a consequence of obesity that's highly correlated with, you know, increased adiposity or increased body fat. We also see, diseases or risk factors like hypertension and, vascular diseases, which were unheard of, years ago. It's just something you would not see in pediatric patients or in youth. And now, you know, it's not even, you know, and it would have been like a rare event. It would have been a case report. But now it's, you know, become, it becomes less of the unfamiliar event. It becomes something more the norm. It becomes something that's less outside the scope of what you might encounter in general practice. And I'm, you know, I'm a family physician. I'm not a specialty cardiologist, but I have kids with, you know, hypertension. I have kids with diabetes. So
it's,
you know,
heartbreaking.
It's a real, it really is. It really is.
So
and
where there's
it's all avoidable.
It's avoidable.
So when you,
when
you see trends, that means something must be going on. Ms. Heller, you recently published a book about how to detoxify the food environment that we live in. Can you tell us a little bit about your book, and maybe, and I know you've given some already, but some tips for folks for staying healthy and maybe keeping their immune system up?
Oh, sure. It's called The Only Cleanse. And really, the only cleanse you need is the one you were born with. Your body is detoxing and cleansing itself 24/7, and that's how we stay alive. And the mission of our body is to keep us alive. So what we want to do, and what we should do, since we have these amazing, phenomenal bodies that we inhabit, is to support our body's natural ability to keep us healthy. So our livers and our kidneys and our lungs and our mouths and our skin are are keeping us healthy all the time. So the book is about what we can eat and how to live to help support our body's overall health. It's about eating healthy food. It's about managing mental and psychological stress. It's about, again, and then I actually talk about changing your food environment, you know, literally rearranging your kitchen and your refrigerator, moving your food from one cabinet to another, because when you want to change habits, a new environment can be really helpful that way. I go into some of the history of detoxes and cleanses, and I deconstruct a lot of the crazy notions on, enemas and fasting and juicing and all kinds of things that people have been doing literally for centuries, and talk about really what's down-to-earth, practical, and sensible, which is, you know, eating really a healthy, more plant-based diet. I do have a 14-day plan to help people stop eating all the processed food, stop eating, you know, all of the sweets, all of the soda, even alcohol, just for those 14 days so that they can kind of reset their mouth expectations and how food will taste, and really enjoy the taste of real whole food. And it's got recipes that are relatively easy and doable. It's all evidence-based, probably almost 300 references in the scientific and medical literature. So the only cleanse you need is the one you already have. It's sort of like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. She always had the power to go home. She just didn't know it. So we don't need to do anything special to cleanse our bodies except to support our body's natural ability to do that.
And is 14 days enough to get your body to not have certain cravings and to change what you're used to, what tastes good and what doesn't taste good?
Well, you know, it takes about 3 to 4 weeks to create a habit and about 3 or 4 weeks to break a habit. But there is research to suggest that in 14 days you can actually start to feel better, start to have more energy, and feel the differences of a change in not only diet but lifestyle, where you're managing stress, you're getting some exercise, you're being well hydrated, you're eating healthy foods. And the research suggests that really in 14 days you will start to feel positive effects of this kind of a lifestyle change. Now, it does take a while to have it become part of your life. And there, I do have a plan called the After Cleanse, which, and I know cleanse and natural and detox are buzzwords, but, you know, my publisher thought that would sell the book. But the After Cleanse, to be honest, is really just saying, okay, so now that you've done this, you know, if you want to, it's a vegan program with the exception of yogurt and honey just for those 14 days, because I have a lot of people say, I don't know how to, what do you mean? I can't be a vegetarian. Ew, I don't want to just eat sprouts. And I'm like, you know, you're eating healthy, fabulous food. There's pasta and beans and vegetables and rice and tofu and all kinds of delicious recipes and foods. And it's just sort of to hold your hand, to take you in a step-by-step process so you can learn that these foods really do taste good and really don't take that much time to make. And afterwards, if maybe you can manage to stick with, you know, meatless meals a few days a week, like the Meatless Monday campaign that started down in John Hopkins, down in Baltimore. That's a great thing. If you can remember to manage your stress and take some deep breaths during the day and drop your shoulders and relax your forehead and your jaw, if you can manage to look at your day and try to be grateful, you know, a few times a day and look at the positive things that are happening in your day so we can combat some of the negativity that we're confronted with on a daily basis, that can help your body, your health, your mind. So there's lots of pieces to the puzzle that we can continue to do.
Mm-hmm. And we're running really close to the end of time here, but just real quickly, doctor, when you talk to your patients, do you talk to them about what Ms. Heller was talking about, sort of approaching being healthy holistically, you know, that it's not just food, but there's other things that we need to do?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And in fact, you know, the marketing terms that I guess the editor suggested in terms of detox and natural and cleanse, you know, I think would be useful in selling the book. And, you know, those are the kind of terms that, you know, I reacted to with, you know, kind of bristling.
I bristle at those terms as well.
It's really refreshing to hear you talk about the book. I mean, I think, as you said before, I think we are, you know, globally on the same page. And I was, you know, when I saw the title of the book, I thought, oh, this is going to be one of these conversations where there's some tension here. But I think we're absolutely speaking the same language. And I absolutely talk to my patients about that. I mean, you know, it's not about single foods. It's not even about you know, diet in isolation. I mean, it's all about lifestyle, right? So it's about the whole package.
Right.
It's about how, you know, it's about stress reduction. It's about getting enough exercise. It's about avoiding toxic substances, and particularly tobacco. And it's about making, you know, healthy dietary decisions. And those things alone, you know, just those simple things that we can do have an enormous effect on our longevity and our quality of life. You know, forestalling chronic disease or preventing chronic disease in the first place. I just had a paper come out recently in American Family Physician where I talk about dietary myths and healthy nutritional advice for clinical providers, and we talk about just that idea that it's about, you know, overall dietary pattern and about, you know, reinforcing the idea of whole foods. And going beyond that, you know, not just whole foods, but whole meals and, you know, sharing a meal with family, enjoying cooking, you know, with friends and you know, really enjoying some of the social aspects of eating and not just the, you know, focusing on the nutritive aspects.
Right. Awesome. Well, I want to thank you both for this fantastic discussion. I think we could go on and on for quite a while, but I need to turn it back over to Priya, and she may have a couple more questions for you if we have time. But again, I really want to thank you both for your time. And with that,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. This was fun.
Yeah, give it back, Priya.
Thank you, man. That was a wonderful discussion, Dr. Lucan and Samantha Ella. We have quite a few questions, but I think we are running short of time. So I will just quickly go over maybe a couple of them. Dr. Heller and Samantha Heller, this one is for you. What are the superfoods for the heart that you recommend?
Superfoods for the heart. Oh, we love superfoods. I'm sure Dr. Luke and I. What is the one food I can eat that'll make my heart healthy? Well, I can tell you, the more plants you eat, the better it is for your heart. So if you can make half of your plate vegetables, whether it's broccoli or zucchini or tomatoes or peppers or eggplant or lettuce or mushrooms, that's going to help replace some of the foods that are bad for our heart or affect our heart badly that are high in sodium, like the processed foods. We want to eat as little red and processed meat as possible. You choose olive oil instead of butter, have nuts and seeds, you know, instead of some of the other, you know, instead of cheese, for example. So the plant foods are so fabulous for your heart. And also managing stress is a great way to keep your heart happy as well.
Thank you, Ms. Heller. Dr. Lucan, the next one is for you. Do you think some of the form of supplements are necessary even for a person eating a balanced diet?
I'm sorry, I missed that. Do I think, can you repeat that?
Supplements.
Do I think supplements are necessary?
Yeah.
Well, so So the literature on supplements is a little hard to tease apart. I mean, certainly I think there have been a number of reports that have come out recently suggesting that supplements are probably not beneficial for preventing some of the chronic disease states that people are concerned about, so things like cancer and cardiovascular disease, probably not. But I don't think there's clarity in the literature about, you know, people don't necessarily take supplements to ward off disease. Oftentimes people take supplements to just feel better, to have more energy, to feel more vital. And so I don't think there is a clear answer there. Myself, I don't take supplements. I don't prescribe supplements for patients. If they want to take them, I try to counsel them towards good sources. But I think that if you have a healthy, balanced diet, you can get everything that you need, you know, from food and from the sun and from, you know, just a healthy lifestyle in general. And I don't think that you need to take pills on top of that. That said, if people want to take pills or are taking pills, I can't say that that's necessarily a bad thing. It's an individual decision, I think.
Thank you, Doctor. Ms. Heller, the next one is to you. The issue of dieting is so prevalent in our society, our culture, and our media. From paleo to wheat belly to a growing interest in vegetarianism, many people are either on a diet, off a diet, or thinking about a diet. What is the healthiest choice?
I know, isn't it crazy? So many people are dieting. And, you know, the word diet, I think, just makes you want to go out and eat ice cream. Just thinking about it freaks people out, and I don't blame them. So I don't like the word diet in terms of, you know, going on a specific diet. I mean, I do have a plan in my book. It's to help people. Really, it's not a diet. It's just a shift in learning how to make healthier choices and to understand that the fads and the trends that are happening are exactly that. They're fads and trends, and we want to focus on being healthy and not being skinny. And so depending on your reason for going on a diet, quote unquote, having your health is everything, and any of us who've been sick or have friends who've been sick with any kind of disease, all you want to just do is feel good and be healthy. And being healthy can be accomplished by making healthy lifestyle choices. So you want to do something you can keep for the rest of your life and isn't just going to take 3 days where you starve yourself or you take some crazy supplement or you do some crazy kind of diet. And seek the advice of really intelligent, well-educated, qualified professionals to help you, like registered dietitians or like your physician.
Thank you, Ms. Heller. We have almost come to the end of our time. Dr. Lucan and Samantha Heller, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Matt, it's always a pleasure to host with you. And the talk and the transcript will be made available on the Cure Talk website. Please visit curetalks.com for details on our upcoming talks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks again. Have a great one.
Thank you.